The people who love you are either stupid or lying. Welcome to Self-Worst.
Are you blessed or are you cursed? With a strong imagination and a spiritual thirst, do you want to confide about the darkness inside? Come and talk about it on Self-Worst.
Hey losers, welcome to episode 45 of Self-Worst. I'm Brad Pearson. I'm the host. I run this shit. My guest this week is Maria Rainup. She is the artistic director of What the Fest, which is starting this very week. She is a veteran filmmaker and film programmer from Estonia. We have a great talk. We talk about burnout. We talk about media saturation. We talk about getting into your 30s and not giving a fuck anymore. It's a great talk. Now, do I know this because I already recorded the interview, or am I clairvoyant? You decide. Let's get into the interview. You just got in. Yesterday?
Yes.
So you're working on What the Fest?
I am artistic director of What the Fest, which is a new film festival taking place at the IFC Center, running on its second year. Let's see, how many years are we doing it?
Right. So you're from Estonia, and you've been working as a film programmer for, you know, like over a decade, something like that, mostly in horror?
Actually not. Kind of balancedly in both worlds of art house and genre movies. So I started almost a decade back working with my best friend for a short film festival, and I was doing events at the time there, organizing kind of parties and weird happenings and stuff like that. And then we needed more people and eyes on the film program. And then I started from shorts, and at the same time, it belonged or was under a very big art house film festival called the Black Knights Film Festival that takes place in Tallinn and the capital of Estonia. And then I started in the guest kind of team a little bit. And then over a very short period of time, one of the main programmers there offered me a position of running a genre film festival that is the biggest in Baltics. And it was already going on for 7 years at that point, in a small morbid city of Haapsalu that has wooden houses and a haunting castle and mud healing spas and a kind of a unique and a special setting with an old like 70s Soviet style of culture house that has a great cinema inside. So I picked up running this festival that I've now run 7 years, and I quit last year. I keep programming it, but I'm not as actively on a festival director position anymore because What a Fest kind of came to my life. And at the side, I've been actually one of the senior programmers for the main competitions for the big art house film festival. So I've spent many lonely summers watching a lot of art house movies, trying to lock the competitions for autumn. I think actually it's a very big strength of mine to have that kind of side of like watching a lot of, not only of course art house movies, but predominant art house movies for competitions. I think my level of understanding what a good program should be like and what a good movie is like has very much come from these two jobs combined.
How do they not all just blend together when you're watching that many movies?
There's a little bit of a trick to that. They do blend. When you're like closing the programs, your eyes are, you know, on literally bleeding at that point and your mind's fried. And when you're watching six great art house film, it feels unfair to the filmmaker and so forth, because you're almost consuming, you know, art house, and there's a, you know, predominantly conflict in it, because you're supposed to, you know, many of these films, you're supposed to take 2 hours
right, these are
off.
These are very delicate, very precious.
Or just dark and hard, and you just, you know. They take a piece of you sometimes out. Like, I felt at times I just can't continue watching movies this day because I'm you know, contemplating over my life, over the existence of humanity, or just my very own existence after that film, because I'm just like staring at the ceiling, lying down.
A lot of existential dread into an afternoon.
But the kind of secret is that you watch a lot of films from different regions, so you try to watch these regions at one go. For example, Iranian cinema is so strong. They have amazing filmic or cinematic language. They're great filmmakers. And when the Film Institute from Iran sends, you know, almost 100 films from, you know, the last 2 year kind of crop for you to see, you do an epic mistake if you try to watch them over different periods of time. Because the film level there is so high that you have to see all of these 100 in, you know, that 1 week period or 2 week period in one go. And then you kind of are able to nail down, like, okay, what is the actually interesting film from that year kind of, you know, kind of crops you have, or what's really the best of them? And then you try to kind of apply the same model on all the regions where you get films from.
It helps to kind of understand the cultural context from which
see some kind of a bigger picture.
Yeah.
It's otherwise nearly impossible. Like, Sweden was not so much anymore, but it used to be one of the great countries for dark comedy. That's what they were famous for. So you did a mistake if you saw different comedies over a long period of time, because they seemed all so very great.
Right.
Because it's always hard to find like a good comedy film for an art house film festival. So you kind of almost waited to package all films together from one country. So to see them in one go and kind of suddenly also see what's the topics or themes filmmakers are exploring during that year or from that country. And then, you know, there would be maybe 2-3 films on the same topic. And now when you see them back to back, you start to realize which one of these films is actually more interesting or better at, you know, kind of creating that loophole into that topic that they are interested in or is a thing at the time.
Right. What got you interested in film in the first place?
That's a long story. I come from a crazy family where my dad's nuts and definitely against TV. So when we lived together at the age of, I think I was 6 or 7, the TV finally broke and he literally threw it out of the window. And at that point, I was only allowed to see a Finnish cartoon called The Mumie Trolls. And then nature shows, because that wasn't lying to you. That was the only honest thing to see in his mind. And I was forbidden particularly to see soap operas or, you know, later movies at evenings and so forth.
Because what was his deal with TV?
Brainwashing. Brainwashing.
He thinks it's all brainwashing.
It's all brainwashing, and particularly soap operas and things that you wanted to see at the time that were the guilty pleasure.
Brainwashing by who? What was his, did he have like a particular conspiracy? Freemasons.
That's
his
thing.
He thought it was Freemasons?
Yeah, a lot of it went down the drain of Freemasons, but in general, his point would be that there is books to read, there is so much more interesting things outside. This is a truth that is put together by someone else. This is a life that is put together by someone else's visions that makes you compare your life with someone else's life and puts you into the ultimate state of unhappiness, because comparison is what takes the joy out of life in large scale and in small scale. So
he's got an okay point there.
That is true.
I'll give him that.
I don't think he should have, thrown out the TV from the window.
Yeah.
As a kid, you're like, okay, my dad's aggressive, but
that's throwing out the TV with the bathwater kind of.
Yeah.
I think you can teach your kids that, there's bad things about media, that it's especially easy for it to kind of imbue you with a sense of, what things should be.
Yeah.
But you know, I never trust people who say that they don't have a TV or that they don't watch TV. Like, to me, like, I don't know. Like,
oh, that's very interesting. I don't have TV and I don't watch TV.
Yeah, I don't. There's people who do that. I don't know. Like, you meet people like that who are just like, I don't have a TV, or I don't do. There's all kinds of people who just like, I don't know, think that they're too good for social media, or think that they're too good to watch Netflix, or think that they're too good to, you know, own a TV and like watch reruns or something. And it's just like, I don't know,
I feel personally touched now because you say that and you're sitting up opposite of a person who is that.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm too good for TV. I don't think I'm too good to waste my life on the shit that comes from there. I still waste my life on social media. I still waste my life, you know, mindlessly watching movies, which is a job of mine, for example. And there's, you know, also a lot of bad movies that I, out of, how to say, respect as a filmmaker myself, watch almost always to the end, or always give 30 minutes of my life away. When I started programming, I was actually spending mindless hours on bad movies because you just don't have that good gut feel and that experience to know if a film's good. You need to spend your life away to learn and have that skill that tells you, even that art house film where the man is standing with a fucking cucumber in black and white beach in Greek, that it's for some weird reason on the 10th minute magic starts working,
right?
You know, so putting so much time into watching movies, I'm particularly proud I don't have a TV and I don't watch TV, because where the hell do I take that time? But it's also, in my case, narrowing it down to, I can speak for myself, it's something of the few things that stuck to me because of the dad, or I never got along really well with him. I always been ashamed of him because he's been crazy and different. And, you know, growing up in the 90s Estonia, where we just got free from Soviet Union and everything west was cool. And, you grew up in that mentality.
You grew up in a completely different culture.
And I grew up in a point where all of this was like, you know, not cool, not allowed. I wanted to be like the other kids, and he tried to teach all along that you shouldn't be like the other kids. So my arguments were like, I wanted to look like the other kids, and dad would be very angry and be like, why do you want to look like other people? You're going to be part of sheep, you know, the masses, whatever. And there's actually a really good point to this, but when you're a kid and your dad's yelling you that, you just get the yelling part. You don't get the message, really. So to come back to the TV thing, years later, when you start to see, you start to see your parents in a different context. You literally learn history. You're like, oh, he grew up, you know, he was born before the Second World War. He's very old. You know, where the life that he had to be was so different from mine. You know, most of the family emigrated to the States, and he was alone in, you know, bombarded Tallinn. Both of his parents died very early. It took me years to literally learn history, learn him, get to know myself, to be a point where you start to see the whole bigger picture. And from that bigger picture, I realized, you know, like you said, it's crazy what, you know, kind of his methods are crazy, but down beneath that is actually, you know, truth you can believe.
Yeah.
And I kind of take pride that whole not having TV thing is the one of the few things that I kind of got from my dad.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it shaped you in a way. In a big way, it sounds like.
Me and my little sister, we have this pact that we'll never marry anyone who wants TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We were like, every year we put like pinky fingers together. It's like, not anyone that wants a TV in the house. We were like,
just no TV whatsoever. Like, yeah. Not a.
But also, honestly, my best friends who know me, when we go to a bar and there's TV, they seat me with my back to the TV because I'm stupefied, zombified in one go. Like,
right.
Because I never had it, I'm not immune to it.
Mm.
I'm literally the example. If you would now in your house put a TV on, I would be glued to it in an hour. You would try to have a conversation with me and I would pick only half of it and so forth. Like, I'm literally zombified by it nearly immediately. I can see that influence also, that I don't have that thing that it would be in my house all the time and I know that it's there. I have this weird thing like, oh my God, TV, and then I start watching it and then suddenly I'm like 2 hours later, what?
Yeah. Well, it's weird because now I feel like we're living in an era where a lot of the more serious, you know, prestige storytelling is coming from television.
Yeah.
You know, now that, you know, in a, I don't know, post-Oz, post-Sopranos kind of world where like all these like prestige HBO dramas are starting to take off. And it's been a while at this point, you know, it's been a good decade or more that like now people are really starting to take TV more seriously. And it's not, it's, you know, it's less just like goofy three camera sitcoms and stuff like that. I mean, it's also just, there's plenty of just dumb as hell. I mean, reality TV is still a huge thing too. So
I just think that the talent itself has much more liberty now in a TV show. And because the 40 to 60 kind of million-dollar pictures are off somehow from the studio formulas, there is no growing space for a good director. And you have that now with shows having so much more money and different VOD platforms fighting over content, fighting over talent. That's created a really good kind of pool for directors to swim in, literally. I think a lot of the good names are now in TV rather than in films. Particularly, you have so much longer time for storytelling. You have so much more space to try things out than the two-hour format where you are in a pool with a ton of other great people who would want to break into the scene like you or try to make their next film like you.
Yeah, we're reaching kind of a critical mass, I think, with the amount of media that's being created, to where now there's so many options for what I can even pick to watch. There's so many new goddamn shows all the time that I just get overwhelmed, and I just go back and like watch old like Star Trek and stuff, because I don't need to pile on any more crap. I don't need a whole nother like serial to be following.
Or it's just you're almost lost on how much good content there is that it makes you numb, or kind of, okay, I don't even know how to start to find out what is the next cool thing because there's so much of the next cool thing out there. Yeah,
it's weird because, I mean, you know, like coming from a filmmaking background, and, you know, I learned, first of all, how fucking hard it is to make a movie, to make even like a web short. It's a vast amount of work and trouble and money. And there's so much of it being made. And honestly, so much of it is not good or memorable or worth anybody's time. And one thing that Caitlin talks about a lot is, you know, watching so much movies and knowing that these people just put their heart and soul into this thing, and it sucks. And it, like, how do you, like, I don't know, is that your experience? Do you see a lot of that? Does that depress you? How do you deal with that?
I think the first interesting question is that, imagine any filmmaker going out, like you said, knowing that they're going to put, you know, their grandma's birthday parties, their personal life, possibly their children or their mortgage into the game, and they set out to make a bad movie.
Yeah.
No.
No, they're not trying to make a bad movie.
That's the thing. Like, everyone who sets out to make a good movie or possibly the greatest film ever made, right? Like, that's the, I'm going to make something great, or I'm going to make this something special, or, you know, I'm going to get my vision crossed, and then it doesn't come out like they want to. That's always been a thing that I've puzzled over, you know, like, where does the level of, like, where does hard work get you and where does talent get you? Like, kind of where that twilight zone, you know, is. But I don't know, like, you watch a lot of bad movies and you just think, oh, what do these poor people now do? And how can I do anything about it? Like, honestly, I can't do much about it. I feel in a weird way that the whole idea of festivals being the gateway between filmmaker and audience is starting to kind of change in the current kind of landscape. I'm not saying that, to me at least, watching a movie in the cinema is still the ultimate experience or the ultimate kind of form of voyeurism, that you can just hide out and step in the shoes of a small pig trying to get from place A to place B, or suffer, you know, writer's, you know, depression with Virginia Woolf and so forth.
What's this movie about? A pig?
Babe.
Oh, Babe. Okay, yeah.
It's always my favorite example. You can be a small pig.
Babe's a great movie.
I think it's a great movie. I think films from end of 80s and 90s, kind of these spec scripts that pulled around with crazy ideas that got made, is some of the greatest kind of, like, I don't know, movie baggage that we can go through. Like, oh, let's make a movie about a man who says yes to everything, you know? And then somebody said, yeah, let's do that, you know? Yeah. Or let's make a movie about two brothers, one of them being, pregnant.
Right.
You know, like, these ideas don't go through anymore. You know, this like high spec scripts aren't like, yeah.
Twins. There's like weird shit like that.
I like it. My favorite film is Death Becomes Her. Like, that's one of my absolute favorites.
That's a fun one.
That is a fun one.
I haven't
one.
Seen it in a while, but I like his other work. You know, he's pretty consistent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's...
Anyway, it's hard to answer the question of what to do with these filmmakers with you know, their films not coming out as they want to, and being in the position of from the festival side, you know, like how much can you support and how much do you also feel that you need to do an extra bit, or how to even get people back, not back to festivals, but, you know, back to the cinema more, or, you know, enjoy festivals, and particularly get the filmmakers feel what the audience feels watching their movie. And I think that's my only thing to hold on to, because I had this great experience last year when we had Evan Katz in Estonia with his new movie Small Crimes, I think, that went straight to Netflix after our European premiere, and he had to like lie to Netflix that he's going to see his Polish roots or whatever his I don't know, like he had to write a few letters like why that he's coming to Europe in the first place, and then he would like to screen it at the film, and Netflix opposed, but you know, eventually we got like one screening just before it hit Netflix. And it's a dark, very dark kind of crime comedy. Yeah. And the Estonian audience laughed throughout the film in places like Evan would have never kind of guessed. No. And it was just so amazing experience for him.
Oh, so it was like a good experience. It wasn't like The Room. It wasn't like everybody's laughing.
No. It was like, it's designed to be a dark comedy. And he was afraid that this humor might be too dark for the American audience. Mm. And then in Estonia, it clicked like perfectly. People laughed even more than he could have ever hoped for, even in his like darkest jokes that he thought, okay, that's just for me. I wrote it there for
like
me.
Like a dark comedy here, I think. You know, we got the Coen brothers.
Yeah, so yeah. You know. But it definitely was an experience of a kind to him sit through in Estonia and like feel that completely different audience kind of, you know, really reacting to the film. And then after that, you know, it goes to Netflix and you never get any statistics. You never know what, you know, did people shut your film on the 18th minute or on the 13th minute? Yeah. Big difference, you know, like did they survive the first act? Are they even interested where your, you know, character or your main protagonist is going for the journey and so forth? So to me, it's like the one of the last meeting points is just the raw atmosphere that movie can do in an audience and the filmmaker there. And then that kind of fragile moment where, you know, you kind of give literally birth to your to your film is only when the audience is also there. It's that meeting point when they react and you feel it. Everybody feels it, how the film works.
Yeah.
And that's what the festivals can do.
Yeah, it might come down to just one moment in that director's life if that's their baby.
Yeah.
And then they get that one screening and it goes well.
Yeah.
And that's great. Because, like, that's the other thing is, like, you know, there's a lot of people who put their heart and soul into a movie and for whatever reason it comes out bad. But then there's people who put their heart and soul into a movie and it comes out good, but no one cares, you know, or like it never gets seen or it gets just completely overlooked. And, like, it's just it's I don't know. It can just be a bummer when you kind of see that happen just over and over, I imagine.
Yeah. But then it can be also very magical and great when you kind of get to the point that the magic happens or it's just the film works. And, you know, the film doesn't have to be ridiculously great. It's just sometimes a film can capture something special and that sometimes can come through the screen.
Yeah.
And sometimes audience feels it and makes it even more special. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that I've seen over the years screenings of movies that I don't think are the greatest films, but then the filmmaker's there, the audience is there, they're willing to meet each other halfway and the film becomes the middleman. And then in the end, the screening, there's this something special in the air. And that, you know, gives such an epic kick to the filmmaker, also the audience, but that person now leaves with a whole new sense to, you know, their career possibly.
Right.
And that's what I think festivals can do. And I encourage, you know, that filmmaker who's afraid or, I don't know, doubting to try as hard as they can to be present at any of the screenings, you know, get the film out first in the first place, but, you know, come to the screening and be there really present with the people.
Yeah.
What else do you have for feedback for your art?
Yeah.
Well, how do you grow? Like, I keep wondering, how do these people grow? Like, are they really that sure of themselves that I just make a movie and put it out there and start making another one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, what do you do afterward? Do you read the reviews? Do you read the comments section? Because it can get pretty ugly, you know? And, like, then you're going to want to, like, I can't imagine doing that. And then just, like, looking at people's feedback of it. Because, you know, me anyway, I'm pretty sensitive about, about that stuff, and I guess you know, like learning how to be less sensitive you know, as I get into my 30s and give less of a shit of what other people think about me and my work. But
that's a good topic, by the way. Yeah, I feel the same. Yeah,
so talk about that a little bit.
I just want to close off because I have this something on my tongue with this that I really think that one of the few ways to grow is that you seek for response to your work, because otherwise you could make your movies to your, you know, to yourself. But when you make movies for a bigger audience, then really is a good Roger Ebert like review the thing that you wanted out of it, and that's it. Like,
yeah.
I, with my short films, have been, you know, surprised over and over again that how much more amazing it is to come out of a screening and have not cool people or great critics or opinion shifters come up and say that, you know, that was a great movie, or, you know, we want to work with you, which is also, of course, very pleasing and flattering and gives you confidence and so forth. But what gave me much more is that, for example, people coming up and saying that they put, you know, 911 into fast dialing after seeing that film because they want to be the person next time doing better. And that just that one comment could give a whole meaning to making a very complicated short film over the period of 3 years. And I think that's not what you're supposed to strive for, and probably you won't make your living with that. And there's a lot of different aspects to this, but I think it's ultimately personal. What do you think is success? What I'm in a larger scale now getting at.
You know, I mean, like, that's the thing, is like most of my favorite movies are kind of cult movies that weren't necessarily big box office hits, weren't necessarily loved by the critics. They just sort of hit a certain nerve, you know, a lot of times it's over time they pick up more of like a following, you know. I got really into like George Romero when I was in high school, and I don't really think any of his movies were like super critically acclaimed necessarily. They just sort of like found their audience of weird people eventually, and now it's, you know, he's a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, getting back to the 30s, let's get to there.
Let's talk about 30s. Yeah. I'm not giving a fuck anymore.
There was this great article I read about 5-6 years ago where there was this 35-year-old woman writing kind of a letter to the 10-year younger generation, or, you know, to women in 20s. And the bottom line was that, you know, I would never go back to my 20s.
Yeah.
And she kind of reasoned it in a super kind of sweet, melancholic, and kind of in a weirdly powerful way. And I remember I read it and I was like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. And now I'm, you know, getting 31 in a couple of months. And I laugh so much because I wouldn't change back to my 20s at all. Because the genuine idea of when you start first time, at least me, again, okay, I can speak for myself. This is the first time when I realized that I'm not immortal. Mm. For me, it's really the first time. I've plowed through my 20s, done some crazy shit, traveled a lot, made crazy sports, drank a lot, like done a lot of things with my body and with my time, both. Yeah. And then this is where suddenly I used to like cut a wound and, you know, it would grow back like Wolverine's wounds or whatever.
Right.
And then now it's like, now I recover half slower. My hangovers are half worse.
Yeah.
My overtraining after periods cut me down to a point I might not be able to walk properly and so forth. So your body is for the first time giving you a very strong, I now see the signs that it was giving earlier, but I just disregarded them because I had so much energy. But now, very sure, I'm not saying, you know, epic changes are happening.
No, you're not like old and decrepit, but like, you know,
but there's a very, very kind of sharp sense that is scrolling through the back of your mind that this is not going to last, this type of energy and power you have. And that means your time will be limited, and that gives you an odd sense of who do you give that time then to. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't made peace within yourself of who you are or how your body is like, or, you know, what do you want to do with your life or whatever, then this is the point where you both realize that you don't have much more time to spend with people that are not really a part of your life, and you don't really have that time to lie to yourself. And to me, that's the greatest part of the hitting 30s. Though, of course, some people hit that point earlier and it has nothing to do with the year, or some people maybe never hit that point. Too bad for them.
Yeah.
But I feel kind of very strongly that it's this moment where I'm just like, I can't lie to myself anymore. That means also I can't lie to other people anymore. Like, who are you? Why are we going out?
Yeah.
What is this job that you said, yes, that's super cool, and you feel fucking empty inside and want to like... I don't know, actually just like run to the opposite direction and so forth. Things that you do in your 20s just because you can and you have the time and the energy and so forth. And you kind of probably look for a sense of belonging in a way that I definitely went too far with.
Yeah.
Like I definitely wanted to be a rich, cool kid, particularly not coming from the rich and cool background. So I spent way too much time on thinking this is what I want and realizing this is so fucking far from where I'm actually happy.
Right. Yeah. Can talk a little bit more about that. Talk a little bit more about like what was it that you eventually made peace with that was not, that you didn't think you were going to be able to, I don't know, live without, that you've since just let go of?
I think there was just this point when I believe that there is this small inner voice within you that has actually all the answers that you want, however dark or hard it gets. There's something within yourself that actually has the answers. And the question is, how do you learn in your life to give that voice space and literally strength to communicate to you, and then believe it and act as the voice says?
Yeah. And how do you not mistake it for the other voice that's telling you the wrong thing?
I think honestly you actually do, but the thing is we want to believe other ways, or we do self harm nevertheless we know it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Because of all these other reasons, because of the societal pressure, because of your secret inner wishes of this and that, you know, everybody nearly, I think, would like to be appreciated, or, you know, feel that they're necessary, or be in a spotlight for once. It's normal human need, but it shouldn't drive over your own personal well-being. And when that happens, there is a very strong sense within you with that, you know, voice of honesty that says, I don't think this is actually a good idea. You're now going trespassing to the side that doesn't actually make you happy.
You're going to the dark side.
Yeah. So I think that voice is within you, and we just learn to disregard it. And then there comes a point where you slowly start to realize that it actually does good to you.
Yeah.
And then you bring it back to your life. So to me, that was a moment where I just started to hear that voice more and more. I started to be in points where I was like, why am I here? Why am I at this? Why am I telling this story of how, I don't know. Oh, let's go back to the raw kind of where I catch myself and think myself, yeah. We are at the party, there's cool people, and then I make myself cool by telling a story of coming from the East Block, having a crazy dad, seeing the banana for the first time, and people are like, wow, okay, you had such a tough time, and like, oh my god, how is it possible that seeing banana for the first time is a thing? I know it's funny for the Americans, I think, and they always react funnily, and I know I get that reaction, so I have these weird party stories that I know that will work. And work for what? Work for what? Work for, you know, being liked?
Right. Win people's approval.
Yeah.
In some way.
There's these moments where I start to see patterns of knowing already how this or that will work for some third things, you know. So if I dress up this way, this will work for that. If I tell these stories, this will work for that. And I'm so fucking tired of it, because ultimately, maybe I wanted to stay home. Maybe I wanted to look terrible and not care about it, because that has nothing to do with the person that is within. And then that voice starts, the more you do these things, to tell you also, you too actually want to be appreciated as you are, not as the image that you portray or want to have of yourself.
Right.
It's like you have yourself and then you have a projected version of yourself. It's a kind of like putting a best picture you have for your profile picture that doesn't look like you, but you know, you like it because it doesn't look like you.
I mean, I spent my whole 20s trying to be some version of myself that I'm really not, or that I have to, it's like flexing a muscle. Like you can hold it for a while, but you can't, it's not really you.
Yeah.
You know, and the amount of time and energy and just like waste of people and love that I've gone through to, you know, people who I've pushed out of my life, who I knew kind of loved me unconditionally and accepted me for who I really am, and thinking, yeah, but I don't want to be accepted for who I really am. I want to be accepted for this thing that I think I want to be.
Yeah.
You know, I want that more, because that gets me higher.
Yeah. And ultimately, the only thing that truly does make you happy in this life is the few people who take you who you are. I really think that though I am career driven and I find great pleasure of having success in things or work, nevertheless, I am not ever happiest at these rare moments when you're, you know, down, sitting down with the people who know you for who you are without any, you know, whatever, jewelry around it or fireworks around it. It's that very you, your family, your friend from high school, that one weird person that stuck through your life and you didn't even think much until you realized that person's been there 10 years, always ready to have a coffee or, you know, come and help if ever needed. And you start to realize that's actually completely invaluable. Like, they're invaluable. That's precious. And this will be the one thing, the kind of the relationships that you have in your life and the how deep they go throughout your life. The meaningfulness of it is the only thing that will make you float when you're, you know, very old.
Yeah.
I don't think work does it, however much you want it secretly, because it's almost easier to kind of put it into a system of how success works. But it doesn't, it's not necessarily or most likely the thing, I think, that will actually keep your true self happy. It's the people around you. It's the relationships, the way you maintain them, and the people, how you hold them in your life, is what gives you truly happiness. And only when you're true to yourself.
Are you a perfectionist?
I don't think so, to be honest. People somehow think I might be, but I don't know. I'm quite a messy person. I'm not too clean, too on time, on, I just don't somehow care to put too much time into trying to be a perfectionist, because that takes time.
Yeah.
Being a perfectionist takes an extra 3 hours of the day you have to make things perfectly. And then I also don't think into perfectness. What is perfect? What is perfect?
I don't know. I mean, like, that's the thing. Is it like there isn't really. It doesn't super exist.
So to work for something that, to me personally, to work for something that I don't grasp is just in conflict. It's just not possible. I find many times that the not perfectness gives me much more joy than the perfectness. And it's nice when things are in order. It's nice when the event goes well. It's nice when things run smoothly. But perfectness is next level from that.
Yeah.
That is when things are timed per second. That is when, you know, everything is painted by drop right. That is when, you know, the film is made frame by frame as you wanted it and so forth. And I think in a weird way, perfectness might suck a little bit of life out of things.
Yeah.
The real life is not perfect. Just the fact that perfect is only a part of the big concept is kind of a proof of that.
Unless you're Stanley Kubrick, you know, and his whole career was, and all of his movies are perfect because he made them so perfectly. And so,
but then again, you know, he drove Shelley Duvall crazy.
Yeah. And then that's the thing is that, like, if you're going to be like that, you need to be like a complete fucking tyrant.
Yeah.
As well. So.
Exactly. So do I want to be that? No, not really.
Yeah. Well, that's what's weird. I mean, especially in the film industry is, you know, there's people like that. And there's people who are filled with, you know, perfectionism and are filled with this, anxiety of this emptiness and need for approval, you know, that I think is especially pervasive in a lot of filmmaking, because
I think it comes from the concept that if you're striving for perfectness, then you care.
Yeah.
And I think that's wrong. I don't care less for making my first film if I don't somehow epically strive for everything to be perfect.
Right.
That's not true. But somehow, that's how the concept works.
Right, if there's some wobble on this one shot, or if the ADR isn't great, or if the script wasn't quite where you wanted it, or like whatever, like you just needed to get it done, you know.
And, you know, also, just getting things done is also a little bit of the other extreme. You know, that's to the kind of the world of, like, sloppy is now possible.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is, like, you know, like, there's... I forget the exact anecdote about it, but somebody was working on the set... I'd heard this on a podcast where somebody was working on the set of a Adam Sandler movie. Cause like, you know, Netflix just like allows them to just churn out like 6-10 movies at a time. And, somebody was pointing out, like the director was pointing out to him that, hey, this isn't, you know, the way you were shooting, this isn't going to work. The gag won't play because it, you know, something with the coverage, like it's just not gonna. And he was trying to explain it, and Adam Sandler was just like, "Who cares? Who cares? Who cares?" You know, just like, because he's just getting money, just wheelbarrows full of money to just like make shit, and he's just churning it out, and he doesn't care. Like he's just like wants to hang out with his friends and like buy everybody Ferraris and stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, that's of course, you know, almost an extreme.
Yeah, I mean, he is definitely an extreme version of that, and it's a weird. It's a weird byproduct of success, I think, to where you get to this point where you're just like pushing stuff out because it'll sell more.
Yeah. And you can also, the other way around, get completely stuck with your perfectness.
Yeah.
Your script is never good enough. That cast is never good enough. You know, like.
Yeah. It's sophomore syndrome. If you have like if you have like one good, you know, one big hit that puts you on the map, and then all of a sudden your follow-up is just like. Ugh.
No, I think that actually is tied into. Okay, maybe in the American cinema or the Hollywood system, it can be approached differently. But when I look at the European art house system, then you go out with your first film, it comes out great, you make a splash. And then the pressure to make the second film becomes so big that you nearly rush into it. And then you also become a little too confident.
Mm-hmm.
It's just your second movie. You know, unless you were born to make movies, and there are some people who just have that type of talent or mind, that I don't doubt that, you know, like, you probably will make only great movies from now on, or, you know, nearly flawless in whatever theme they tried to portray. But for most of people, the second film is the hardest because you rush into it, you're worried that, you know, you miss your kind of tidal wave that you're now surfing on, and you need to, like, go in quickly. And two, you become too confident. You suddenly don't realize that you put all your good ideas, all your energy, all of that you were like waiting on a little tiny gold button. Okay, I'm going to make my first film, and you kind of throw everything you have in there.
Yeah.
And then your reservoir is a little bit empty by the point you rush in to make your second film. So that's, to me, mostly the reason why the second one, people are like, what happened?
Yeah.
Nothing actually happened. It's just there's this... Yeah, rush and then kind of empty brain by the point of like this pressure that maybe I will never make a movie again. Yeah. I have a friend who's convinced that you can only call yourself a filmmaker. And I always kind of contemplate over that when you've done three movies. Because now you made your second film, you probably hit a bit lower mark than with the splash with your first film. Now try to get your third made. And then right. you have three, you know, features behind. Now no one can doubt you've done through the whole like catapult kind of process of actually landing to a spot that you have three features behind you. You've gone through the low of the second and the really hard climb of the third.
Yeah.
And then you're in a point where you're like, okay,
I can now call myself. Yeah, then you're actually established, better yeah. or worse.
Yeah, and people are like, yeah, but if I made my first movie, how am I less of a filmmaker? You know, like maybe I'm Jennifer Kent and waited 12 years to make Babadook.
Right. Has she made anything else since? Because that movie was Nightingale. Fucking amazing.
Yeah. Her new film came out in Venice last year and is now kind of starting to finally circulate on the festivals.
I want
to
see it.
It's great.
I fucking love the Babadook.
And it's nothing to do with the Babadook in the sense that it's not a stylized boogeyman movie.
Right.
It's a revenge picture set in the colonial Australia. A woman who goes on a revenge trip across, you know, the marshlands kind of with one Aboriginal like rope pathfinder, and they slowly become friends though they are hating each other, both being the ultimate outcasts. It's a dark movie. It's more of a drama, and Jennifer herself is now in a point that she doesn't want the genre film festivals to play the film because she doesn't want to be pigeonholed as a horror director.
Right.
Which is a kind of a tough thing because I love the Babadook. It's one of my favorite examples when it comes to what I think is a great genre movie, because great genre movie is on the surface, a piece of great entertainment. But on the undersurface, it speaks of something much bigger. Like my best example of a school bullying movie, such a social theme, is Carrie. Or Babadook is actually a story of if you don't deal with pain,
yeah, it's about grief.
Pain will make a form and make you deal with it.
Yeah.
How beautifully epic is that? You know, you have to learn to let go and deal with it, whatever it means. Only then it will, you know, leave you in peace. And in a weird way, I find it from the festival perspective myself hard that I can't play her film because she's pretty strict about no genre film festivals. And at the same time, I kind of, as a filmmaker, understand her quest because great genre movies belong to the Oscars. Great genre movies, you know, belong to the A-list competitions. Yeah. You know, they're great genre movies like Silence of the Lambs. They're, you know, should, you know, own their right to be much more.
Yeah.
So she's kind of working or fighting that quest of not having the greatest genre excluded somehow from the art house scene.
You're a filmmaker as well?
Yes.
How many movies have you made, though?
I've made four.
So you are a filmmaker. You've made more than three.
Short films. I don't know if that counts. So
What's the cumulative runtime of all of them?
Oh, yeah, it's a feature, definitely.
Okay.
Actually, I was working last year on a Fox Searchlight picture called Tolkien, which is a biopic about John Ronald Royal Tolkien,
who
is a great author. Tolkien. And I was doing a second unit on that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 2 weeks with a full-blown, like, 30-people crew. So, you know, it almost, you know, some people shoot a feature film in that time with the same amount of crew. So to me, that was a great experience. But yeah, I'm prepping for my first feature film.
What's it? Can you talk about it a little bit?
I guess I can. It's not. Not really signed or formulated as in, you know, form of legal papers and so forth. And the problem is, it's adaption of a short story, and we haven't, you know, signed it with the author. It's gonna happen next week. So in that sense, it's like, should I talk about it? But she's this kind of feminist writer in Estonia who has two very interesting books, and the first one is a collection of short stories, and there's a story called 48 Hours, and it tells a story of this mid-30s lady who's kind of cynical about life, overeducated and a little bit dark. It's not really my character, I guess. I'm goofier. But nevertheless, the story I like a lot, which is she discovers that she has only one egg left and her ovulation starts, you know, basically the same day. So in 48 hours, she has to get impregnated if she ever wants a child. And it's such a weird kind of concept because it embodies dark kind of humor just for the fact that you're looking for sperm in the fucking city.
Right.
And I like that idea.
There's no shortage of it.
Actually, you know, depends on the character. Yeah. Like, you know, she starts from fancier place. No, she starts at home, you know, picking up the phone and thinking, who are the people you call for asking, hi, I really would need a baby and I don't really need you, but could you come in and put it in?
Right.
And then, you know, none of that happens. And then she starts from fancier places and then throughout the night kind of ends up in a really like dodgy kind of dive bar. And it's just like looking at these drunk kind of beer stomach, kind of overgrown bearded guys and going like, wow, okay, that's pretty desperate. And I'm not going to spoil the end of the story, but there's so much, the way the character inner monologues work are an amazing tool in my mind for the director to make this film, not a fantasy film, but definitely visualize what is happening in her mind at the same time of this quite straightforward kind of time capsule story. Yeah, when she first, for example, when she first hears about it, she's like, okay, normal people think of baby dance or doing the baby dance, which is a phrase for this type of sperm hunting. And she only thinks of mobilization, aggression, hunting. And like, and I want to like visualize all this because it's kind of very raw insight to a perspective that only a woman can have. Mm-hmm. And I myself not really want children, to be very honest. So when I would be put into that kind of perspective, I would definitely be in a point where I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Six levels of tantes hell and like full blown turmoil within, like, what do I do?
Yeah. Yeah. To try and find empathy with a character who wants something that you don't want is, you know, that's the trick. Are you going to shoot it in Estonia or here?
That will most likely happen actually in Finland.
In Finland?
Or in Estonia. We're seeing into that.
What language are you going to shoot it in?
Finnish or Estonian? Hmm. I don't know. I don't, in that sense, I don't think language is a barrier whatsoever. I'm right. Not scared to do a film in Swedish. Or like, nowadays, it's everything is like possible. I think you have a language coach, you have a translator and so forth. And I wrote another story that happens here in United States of America, but I can't do that as my first film. It's just, it doesn't work in the Estonian setting. It doesn't even work in the European setting because it's a story of this one, this young filmmaker who works as an assistant to a big wannabe entering to the Hollywood system director. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this passive aggressive relationship that these two people have. And she ends up living in a house of a very famous stunt woman who, you slowly realize, is actually a witch.
Yeah. So it's a kind of a uniquely American story.
No, it's actually a story that happened to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I ended up living in a witch coven.
You ended up living with a witch?
No, I ended up living with a famous stunt woman for a couple of months in a ridiculously pretty beautiful mansion. And I was working as an assistant to, you know, breaking into Hollywood system director. And I had grown into a filmmaker myself, so we were in constant conflict of how this film should come out, and he was very kind to let me, you know, give that much opinion.
Right.
And now when I think back, I'm like, wow, I was a nuisance. And then I ended up at the same time living in this mansion that looked to me, particularly from the East Block, so wealthy. And it took me like weeks to start like kind of looking closer and going like, that's not actually wealthy. That's like someone's idea of wealth.
Right.
And then, you know, the gated walls and the idea of what's hiding behind these rich people's gated houses started to kind of play in my head. And
you started to find potions and wands everywhere.
Not that. She had a lot of cats. And over the time, we started off really good as friends. And then she turned really cold and really, and then living there became super uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And then you start to blame yourself first. You're like, I had to do something wrong. I left the bloody tampon somewhere. I didn't wash my dishes. I've done something right. Wrong. And at the same time, there is a lot of odd things like cats should be fed only a specific time. There's a room on the third floor. No one is allowed to enter. And there was a parrot that spoke like her. And that parrot creeped the shit out of me all the time. And then at some point, I don't remember if I dreamt it or I made up that story, but I really thought at some point that the parrot is saying to me with her voice that you're gonna die. And then it was a point where the atmosphere in the household had gone so weird. And right. It's just that she couldn't tell me that she wants to move out. And instead of telling me, we spent weeks in this household avoiding each other. Me completely convinced I've done something wrong. And that starts to eat you alive from the inside. And then my fantasy started to kind of save me. I started to think that the cats are her surveillance cameras and, you know, the parrot is something fucking evil. And whatever is evil in this house, the most
witches
evil thing...
are known for being passive aggressive as well. So it all adds up. Witches are known for being like really... you know, they...
No, it was just... And then...
Bad roommates.
Oh, they make bad roommates. So then there was this one night when I was playing with myself in my room and my room's door... closes really badly. It had all carpeting in the second floor of the house, so you know you really needed to push to kind of close it. And then I'm like playing with myself, and then I'm like, something is wrong. Like, you're in a dark room, you can't kind of make out what's else in there. And then I like look up from the covers, and there's one of the cats just kind of staring at me, just sitting really calmly and just staring at me. And I'm like, this is creeping me out so bad.
You're having a moment. You kind of need.
Yeah,
privacy.
But even that, how the hell did it get in?
Cats
you know?
Are very sneaky, you know?
They're super sneaky, but through a door, and by that point I'd learned to check that they're not in my room, because I don't like cats too much, which is the funny bit, because I had to now live with six of them. But I was like, how did it get in? Like, that's not, it's hard for me to get through that door. Anyway, and then of course the fucking, sorry, I keep swearing.
It's okay, you can swear.
Okay, so of course that room on the third floor. How many times I tried to sneak in and understand what is in it, and I couldn't. And then I started to be convinced when the atmosphere got really bad that there's something really big living there, and I'm just food for it. Because she kept, you know, commenting that when I'm cooking, normally people say, you know, the food smells good, and she would keep saying that I smell good, and it's just like, it was just weird. Right. And then I realized, and then, you know, the comments of like, oh, it's nice that you make sports, or I eat super healthy, and I don't know, her fridge was full of cat food, really. I thought by the end of the time living there that they just eat cat food. And she's one of the cats.
Food.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so all of this kind of mixed together in my head.
Did you ever see her going to the bathroom to take a shower, or is she always just like sitting on the couch licking herself?
Yeah, no. That's the problem. I left every morning early to the big studio to work and got back really late. So one of the problems was that she was hoping that she would make like a cool, youthful young friend to hang out with. She had big projects. She was super made up, a really like lovely person. Don't get me wrong. Like I owe her for a lifetime for, you know, having the chance to live in an area of a house like that.
Right.
Plus I have a great story. In my opinion, I think this is going to be a fun movie. That should be the film done in a vein like Death Becomes Her that has this like comedy to it, but actually also some really like oddly dark moments.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you got out of it okay. You didn't get fed to cats. You don't have a hex on you or anything.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, and then she had a lot of wine, bad wine that we had to drink all the time. And then at some point I was like, this is probably something that I'm fed early into before it turned into something.
Right.
You know, that character in that film that I've now written most definitely doesn't get off from that house with a completely, you know, clean skin.
Yeah.
That's just not possible. You know, like you...
Like Rosemary's Baby. They're like slowly...
Yeah.
Kind of
there's something...
Through the whole thing.
Yeah. There's something, you know, special that she's going to take with once she escapes.
You might not even figure it out for a while.
Oh, no. Like she doesn't. Is. That's for
Your
sure.
Your hair is going to start falling out.
Although it's also a joke on the film industry, because I am sorry, but when you work in the much higher level, there's so much drinking involved, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we have Tuesday evening, we should go through the studio notes, we should have a glass of wine. And then you're like, oh, it has moved to Monday. But we should do it also Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Right.
And then we should go out on Friday and have more. I definitely... And that's, of course, not to do with anything of the producers of the film or whatever. It's your fucking personal choice to have that wine or not. You know, like, let's not forget that. But it's easy to have once it's there and everybody does it.
Yeah. And I also feel like if you're working in that kind of environment where, like, you know, the hours are so long and the work can be, like, so kind of arduous. That,
yeah. And you put so much time and effort to make it good, you know, that,
you know, you don't punch out at 5 o'clock and go to the bar like most people.
You carry that pressure of, you know, working on the first big studio film, like, I don't know what, like, Atlas right. is fucking carrying the whole world above him. Going to the mid story, but it's a thing, definitely. Like, you're so you go to sleep with, you know, thinking how we're gonna edit the film better, or if there's a chance to do that, then you go to work and you think, you know, what else can we do better, you know, mm-hmm. like, and then you do that for months.
On that note, how do you avoid burnout?
You have to have a proper burnout once.
Yeah.
I had two burnouts, really bad ones.
Yeah, can you talk about those?
My first burnout was when I had run a film festival for a couple of years, and I just was about to finish school, and I had taken too many projects, and I had put too much time into the festival. As a festival director and creative director kind of combined in one position, it was particularly hard. And the problem with the burnout is that you take something that you love and you turn it into something you hate. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the worst things that you can do to yourself. If you ever are in a point that you're supposed to work on something that you love, but you can't open your computer anymore because you do not want to see the emails, that you're unable to answer them, you're a point where you don't want to pick up your calls mm-hmm. that are work-related, then you need to really seriously now kind of really quickly, like, assess the situation and take time off. Take yourself somebody to help, give your workload away, because that will end up, that's the beginning of your burnout, or you're already way into the burnout. And the funny thing is, there's no really good moment to kind of really grasp when does it start. But to me, that's the first point. When this happens, you're getting screwed in about 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
Then you don't want to show up anymore to your own workplace or to your own set or to your, you know, your team or whatever you're doing, because that right. starts to accumulate from that point on. You want to run to the other direction. You come to a point where you just want to, you know, buy a plane ticket and leave the country nearly. And then that might make you crash your whole life at that point.
Yeah. Because you start it can really, like, you know, you can get so, I don't know.
You get sucked into it.
Like the dominoes, you know, like the dominoes will fall and you just, like, if you get so burnt out on a project that you not only don't want to work on the project anymore, you don't want to even, like, do this shit with your life at all anymore.
Yeah. You just don't want to even live in that city yeah. anymore. And that's because you've now failed at, you know, your job so in so many points and areas that you fucked other people over.
Yeah.
That's what the problem of the burnout is. It's not when it gets bad, it's not just you. You start to fail in what you do, and that starts to help other people fail in what they do. They don't get answers from you. They don't get decisions from you, whatever you know, your job is, or, you know, they now need to look for another person, you know, if it's another type of a job. But anyway, bad burnout is not about you. You're starting to fuck up other people really bad at that point. That's why you want to leave the country, because you can't take the shame anymore of all the damage that you can't anymore control.
Yeah, that's the only thing that's, like, really stopped me, I think, from having, like, a complete meltdown at certain points, is just like, well, I'm beholden to other people, though, who, you know, don't deserve to have their whole thing ruined because I can't handle it anymore.
Yeah. And then you also take an old taste out of something that used to give you a good meaning.
Yeah.
That's very harmful for your being, I think. It's almost unfair that you're doing that to yourself or to the thing that you love, both ways. Like, you're not only failing the project, like you said, but you might fail the whole, you know, I don't know, now you don't want to make movies anymore, you know, like, because you burned out so badly, or you don't want to take a big project up anymore, even if you're really good at it, actually.
Yeah.
And then we come to the interesting point of how does the society you live in handle this? Because one of the most amazing things I saw working on a really big movie a couple of years back in Finland was when our line producer burned out. And she is one of the best line producers in the country. She's really great. And there was a point where you started to see that she's like stuck with like tiny bills. And nobody could have noticed it before. Because when, you know, production is going, big money is flying, big things have to be taken care right. of. You need to think in big units. And then suddenly she's like mailing back and forth over something, you know, $400 bill. And you're like, nah, that's a warning sign.
Yeah.
And that's literally was the point where she couldn't anymore grasp anything big and was in such a desperate point that she just wanted to get one thing done in a day. And couldn't anymore because the shame and the guilt over all the big things not being done even ruins that last attempt. Because it was just way too much. It just moved on so quickly to like 5-country co-production. We were flying between countries and it was just a lot to handle. And, you know, budget issues, blah, blah. But then how the Finnish society, for example, takes care of it is that they found a new blind producer, gave her a compulsory 6-month holiday. Mm-hmm. With the only quest that she would come back and still want to take movies.
Right.
Up. Just like just make more
some,
movies.
Take some time off.
Yeah. But the whole point of like sending her away was to make sure that she comes back to a point she wants to make movies.
Right.
You know? So to me, I found it so beautiful.
Yeah, that is nice.
That like, you don't like send a person away and say, you know, almost fucked up the whole film. Lucky right. that we caught in the right moment, you know, externally, you know, people could come up and say, why didn't you say, you know, why haven't you spoken and so forth. People kept out of that conversation. They were like, we don't want you to lose the taste of life. That's first. And that mm-hmm. might happen with a burnout. You might come to a point where you have suicidal thoughts, really bad. Two, we don't want to, you know, lose taste of making movies out of all the shame and guilt that comes from being in that point of your burnout. And, you know, just first, you know, you also have children, other life, take care of it. You know, we'll manage. This is a production. Life doesn't, you know, collapse.
Right.
And that sanity and healthiness of valuing human life above that, you know, kind of ongoing, you know, a lot of investment movie happening at the same time. Yeah,
because like, that's the thing is like a film production, it feels like it's do or die.
Yeah.
You know, it can really, yeah. like when you're caught up in it, it feels like if we don't get this shot done today, the world will explode mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. you know? And like that amount of pressure, like you can really only live with it so long.
Yeah.
What helped you move past the burnout?
First is realizing that you have it. That's really important. Mm-hmm. Because the problem is when you don't tell yourself I'm having a burnout or I had a burnout, you know, you don't realize it. You just come to a point where you can't get up. You confuse it with depression. You can't get up. You don't want to do things. Food doesn't taste, all kind of weird things that kind of come along to your personal burnout. That's mine, for example. Realizing that you had it and then making peace with it and like really sitting down and saying to yourself, I am having a burnout or I had a really bad burnout is really important because if you don't do that, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. If you don't acknowledge it, it will find you and hunt you down and poison the next half of year in your life, I think. I think there's something really important in life coming in terms with things, helping yourself to deal with them by first acknowledging it. When you do that, your brain is like ready to move on to the process of kind of damage controlling itself. If you don't do that, if you don't acknowledge, there's no clear signal within yourself of, you know, I actually want to deal with this or this actually was a problem and I acknowledge it. And then it starts to linger on at there.
Right. It's the Babadook.
Yeah, it is actually the Babadook.
It's the Babadook.
And then suddenly you find yourself half a year later trying to, you know, open your computer or answer emails in another stressful period. And that starts to suddenly, that feeling, bad feeling you had long time ago, you've forgotten. You've had parties, holidays, whatever in the between. You don't think about it anymore. You think you're fine. And then suddenly, in a similar context, not that bad, you have the anxiety, the shitty sleep, whatever, kind of crawl back. And you're like, where did this came from? That project's not that hard. I'm good. I'm fine. And it doesn't, I think you have to acknowledge it first. Then the really hard part is that if you fucked up, you need to go and acknowledge that too.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. You need to go walk up to people and say, I didn't send emails on the right time. Little things are lagging because of that. Or I didn't send them at all. And there's a lot of information out of the loop. I'm sorry. I need help. Can we hire one more person?
Yeah.
Or I need out. I can't do this anymore. That's the hardest of them. But you should be able to actually go through that too. Not with a fear that, you know, you won't find a job again or people will blacklist you or whatever. Your life is so much more valuable than that. So much more. And burnout, I think, can get that bad. I came to a point that I said, I'm leaving. And that was for the fact I didn't acknowledge my burnout. I had developed a drinking issue and smoking issue to, on the surface, help myself. But actually, it's an addiction. So when the super hard period had kind of passed and I continued only with semi-hard period, then there was a point where I should have told myself, you're in a nearly point of like trashing your body and absolutely incapable of kind of pushing forward.
Right. You're in a holding pattern. You're getting through the day, but
it's taking a massive toll. And at that point, I should have said, you know, you're having an epic burnout, but I didn't because I wanted to continue on the project. I was convincing myself, you know, now it's getting easier. You know, you get back on track, you'll do this and that. But then I realized a month later, I've taken my bad habits with me, you know, like I'm not happy. I'm killing my relationship at the same time. A lot of things that sneak in and make it and tie it into much bigger picture than just this one work scenario that you're, you know, working with how to do this better. So when that continued a couple of months, I realized I can't. This is not okay. I need out. And it was very unfair to the project because they were not really aware of why this situation had happened and so forth.
And then, because to them it just seems so sudden because you had been just sort of white knuckling it and
exactly. Yeah. And like nothing was like, and the funny thing is, and I didn't burn anything down. Nothing really bad happened.
Right.
It's the accumulation of all the things that you did 2 days late, all the emails that you answered five days late.
Yeah.
It's the accumulation of this that you only know. They don't. Nothing didn't get really undone. Nobody missed a plane because of me. No, you know, there wasn't things that didn't happen because of me. Something big that, you know, put. That's actually the scary part or the bad part, because that might now bring the problem to the surface.
Right.
If you burn something down, people start to realize, oh, you're tired. But if you don't, and you kind of almost catch every curveball that comes, almost. Then nobody kind of also knows that something is wrong. I left the job, moved back to Estonia, went to my grandparents' place, and I hid out there weeks straight. Completely petrified. I've done the worst decision in my life. And literally raking through the onion field and chopping up wood and putting it to the winter, like whatever you call this shed.
You needed just some like Zen work.
Honestly, more than Zen work, I needed to do something visible with my hands. And I tell you, this is one of the greatest tricks in life that I recommend now after it helped me a ton to any creative person on this planet. Do something for a while with your hands, because we work inside of our mind or in Google Documents in some cloud or, you know, literally development process or finalizing something. Even when you make a movie, you don't have something tangible.
Yeah.
And something tangible gives it a sense of reality. Unfortunately, this is how our mind perceives things that are real. You touch them.
Right.
That's just one of the things that helps us so much with, you know, what is this? And I needed to do something with my hands because I'd been working in my head for months and months and months and months straight. So now every day I did a quest. I'm going to do this much of wood, then it's going to be a big pile of mess, and then I'm going to clean up the pile of mess into the shed. And that gave me some kind of odd sense of being able to succeed at something, being able to see the result in the same go.
Yeah.
And that gave me this immense pleasure of just kind of calming down and realizing, okay,
yeah,
if you can do this, you can do more. Now yeah. we're back in the basics.
Yeah, that's drawing for me, because you're just like making an actual image, you know. Especially I draw a lot on the iPad, but I think actually drawing like ink and pen, you know, ink and paper actually is somehow even more soothing. I think Caitlin cooks, you know, and I think, you know, cooking dinner like really like unwinds her, even if she's, you know, done a lot at the end of the day. And like, to me, that seems like, oh man, like I don't want to bother with that. But like for her, it's like, it's a process. It's got a beginning and end. It makes sense.
Exactly. You know, it has a beginning and end, and it makes sense. Whatever it is for you particularly, find it and make it a tool for you. One of the good tools in the box of how do I mend my mind?
That is great advice. That's a good note to end on. We are going over an hour.
Oh.
Do you have anything to plug?
What's a plug?
Like a plug to promote, to tell the audience about, like, hey, go check me out, check out my work, find out what I've been working on, anything to kind of advertise to the listeners.
If I have anything to plug that's not a butt plug.
Right. I mean, we'll go ahead and put a blanket endorsement on butt plugs, too. I mean, I haven't really used them, but I endorse them. I think that they're a net positive for humanity.
People I endorse like everything them. That includes play into your sexy times.
Yeah.
Okay. but yeah, you should totally, besides the butt plugs, check out What the Fest here in New York. It's going to take place this upcoming weekend. And we've put a lot of time and effort into a program of not only good movies, but the movies come along with small events. So there's a talk by one of the chief coroners in New York about pathology and how a body gives information. And there's only, you know, a handful of pathologists in the whole America. So it's quite a rare chance to kind of see one passionate one in real life.
Yeah.
I just thought, you know, coroners are perceived so off in it's horror films. I mean, always eating in one hand and then like doing something with their other and so
it's
forth.
It's always like some creep played by like Brent Spiner or something.
In a dark cell or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's actually not true. And
it's
there's
always Brad
a lot
Dourif.
Of... Yeah.
It's always like some creepy looking guy.
But yeah, so this coroner is going to give a talk on pathology and how we perceive information and what kind of information our body gives, dead or alive. We have a doomsday specialist whose specialty is Doomsday in New York. Speak before a doomsday film from Sweden called Unthinkable, which is this year's doomsday film that you didn't know you need in your life, but you do. It's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, that's something that's not on people's minds enough is the apocalypse these days.
Yeah.
I don't think about that on a fucking hourly basis.
That's actually Twitter. Funny. I do it all the time. Yeah. Like, world's about to end. Should I give in all my principles of, you know, trying to be a better person and not consume and like not eat meat and not have fucking one go-to coffee cups in my hand all the time and trashing the planet? And then at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but the planet is going to explode in like 2 days.
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah. It's very hard. It's a big...
It's a hard balance.
It's super
strike.
Hard balance.
Really
like, this really is calling out to ask yourself, like, what kind of a human you are and how much principle has to do with what keeps you together or makes your skeleton. But she's a great doomsday specialist. And then it's actually really interesting of how does she approach as a specialist this very odd, you know, field of kind of where are the things around New York, from your water to electricity to communications to so forth, and how, you know, if something happens, what fails first and what does it do?
Right.
We have a bear, eat a bear raffle after Body at Brighton Rock that includes all kind of bears to eat, including some real bear meat.
Bears?
Yeah, bear. Like,
I mean,
the Urst,
like
animal.
People are eating bears.
No, after the film, they can. They, in the Q&A, if you want, you can
like
have
a bear.
Of
little, like bear sausage, bear.
No,
fries.
I brought some canned bear.
Canned bear.
You can win it. Yeah, at the Q&A. That's actually a surprise. I told you that's a surprise. Don't tell anyone, guys. yeah, so there's the specific events designed to go with the films. Some are easygoing, some are like more, you know, picking on your brain, but ultimately that's what I want to pick on people's brain. I think genre movies are great that way. You can, you know, that audience isn't afraid for a doomsday talk, and I would like people come out of the 2-hour experience and there's more than they expected to go home with. Oh, and the Sunday, March 24th, is a so-called Black Sunday, What the Fest style. I have put together a focus on contemporary Satanism. So we start from late 60s with a documentary on Anton LaVey and founding the Church of Satan in San Francisco. Then we have Grady Hendrix, who's a great author, give a live talk about the satanic panic in the 80s. And then we finish off with Hail Satan with the Satanic Temple and its kind of work, which is basically political trolling.
Yeah.
To kind of empathize that freedom of speech is one of the main things in the Constitution. And, you know, Americans really are not predominantly a Christian nation.
Yeah.
At least when you invite, you know, God to school, you should invite Satan too.
Right. The whole thing was a troll. It's a satire. Satan.
Yes, but Satan is just a symbol. Satan is a symbol of rebel. That's right. The one angel that got cast out, right? So it has nothing to do really per se with the biblical understanding of Satan. It's more the symbolic meaning of rebel, and all contemporary Satanism, depending of whatever the body is, either Church of Satan and Satanic Temple are actually different types of kind of bodies of Satanism. But the bottom line for both, for all contemporary Satanism, is kind of equality in all possible means, from sexual to economical to whatever. I screamed Hail Satan at the end of Hail Satan going, God damn, I'm closed-minded. Like, I'm one of the people who thinks it's all about leather jackets and church burnings, completely influenced by the satanic panic, having no idea about how amazingly including Satanism is to all what I believe is good in society.
Now that is where I want to end the interview. Yeah. Perfect. That is perfect. Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Thanks once again to Maria Rainup. Great guest. If you are in the New York area and you are listening to this the actual week that it comes out, then please go see some movies at What the Fest. They show a lot of really good stuff. I went last year. There was some really incredible stuff. So if you would like to support the show, please go to patreon.com/selfworst. We're going to be doing a little bit of a drive to get more people to the Patreon coming up soon. Still working on that. Look, I'm doing this shit part-time. I only have so much time to dedicate to it. But, look, if you don't have the money or don't give a shit enough about the show to actually contribute $1 a month, that is totally fine. You are more than welcome to keep listening. I love you just the same. But please rate and review us on iTunes. That helps. Tell a friend, word of mouth, post on social media. If you're friends with me on social media, haven't blocked me yet due to all my lefty rantings, then please share the post. I put this on all my socials every time. Just hit share. Hit share as in share, not share. Don't hit share. You know what I'm saying? Because I will come after you. Music is by Shea Bartel. I am Brad Pearson. Until next time, go out and fail. It's good for you. Hail Satan.